We're in this series that's called Seeing and Believing. And the idea of seeing and believing is we're looking at where our culture is at and how many of the beliefs in our culture have actually found their way into the church, have found their way into the lives of people who follow Jesus. If we actually want to take a step back and look at some of those lies, those myths that we believe as a culture that maybe we've embraced even in the church, to actually identify those things, to see them, to point them out, and then actually to turn to Jesus and to his word and to believe and embrace the truth of the gospel. That's what this series is about. We're in a time when people are coming to church less and less. We're in a time when people think they can live life without God more and more. And so this is very fitting for where we're at as a society and as a church in Portland. I don't know if you know this about me. I'm a sucker for reality TV shows, particularly the ones that are about survival. So like Survivor Man and Dual Survival, those kinds of shows. Anytime basically where human beings are living off the land. I watch those shows when I'm flipping through channels and maybe I'll hit Discovery Channel and you know, there's a show about survival or living on a frontier or something like that. And I'll think to myself, I can do that. I could actually do that. I kind of fantasize about it. And then the show ends, and I turn off my TV, and I go up to my kitchen, and I put a cup of hot water into the microwave, and I make myself a cup of tea, and then I go back downstairs and plop down in front of my gas fireplace and take out my iPhone and log on to Facebook. And, you know, it's I don't really know why I think I would enjoy, you know, surviving, living off the land. I don't know where that comes from. But if we're honest, I mean, technology's awesome, right? It's cool. Survival's a fantasy that most of us don't actually want to live. Even if you're one of these people who complains about technology, which I can be at times, I've noticed that ever since I turned 40, I complain about things a lot more. And if you're one of those people who you know, kind of moans and groans about technology and the internet and all this, and then you still love your heated seats in your car, right? I mean, you love that. You love that. You're so glad, whether you know it or not, you're glad that you don't have to worry about dying from smallpox because medicine has figured that one out. Technology and human innovation have given us this real sense of comfort and this sense of security. They've improved our lives in so many ways, but they've also seduced many of us into thinking that we can live the good life, we can have the good life without God. This is actually a human story that repeats itself over and over again. We want the good life, but we don't want God to be a part of it. This is what we're going to be looking at today. A couple weeks ago, Tim talked about freedom. And freedom is in our culture, this idea that we need to remove our limitations. So whatever limitations God puts on our finances or our sexuality or whatever, we actually want to try to remove those limitations and have freedom to do and live as we please. And we believe if we do that, we'll attain a better life than we currently have. Technology actually fuels that lie. Human innovation begins to make us think and see and seduces us to actually think, you know, I don't need God. I've got the internet. I don't need God. We've got medicine. And so we find ourselves in this place where technology is actually our savior in many ways. And the story that we're looking at this morning is actually an ancient example of how this has been repeated throughout history. It's the story of Babel or Babylon. It's the same place, Babylon. And it's all about humans making the world better by freeing themselves from God and putting their hope in human ingenuity and technology. What we're going to see today is that instead of trying to eliminate all of our needs, God actually calls us to embrace our need for him. That's where this story is going to drive us today. So we're going to look at it in two parts. The first part is how we see the people of Babylon running from God, rebelling, and trying to find the good life without him. And then the second part is how God intervenes, and in his mercy, he actually makes their plans fail. If you've got a Bible, it's Genesis chapter 11. the first nine verses we'll be looking at this morning. Genesis chapter 11, we're going to look at verses 1 through 4 first, and then stop reading at that point. I know that some of you like to read ahead, but just stop, and then we'll read 5 through 9 in a little bit. Now the whole world had one speech, or one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." The story of Babylon opens with this group of people who all speak one language, and they've migrated east. Now, throughout the book of Genesis, anytime that you have people either moving east or coming from the east is always associated with a god. It's a godless direction, and that's not meant to offend you if you live in Gresham. It's godless. It's associated with godless. When Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden, they went east, away from God, away from the place God had originally designed for them. When Abraham and Lot went their separate ways, Lot went east, and east was Sodom, which was a godless city in many regards. East is associated with godlessness. So for these people, east is a hint. For us, east is a hint. It's a clue that where these folks are headed is actually a bad direction. See, for these people, their move away from God was actually propelled by technology. They figured out how to make bricks, which was a huge breakthrough for them. It actually became a point of pride for them. Basically, they thought they were awesome because they could make bricks. And they realized that they could use their awesomeness, their brick-making ability, to build a big city with a big tower and make themselves look even more awesome. It wasn't that making bricks or building a city with a big tower were heinous sins somehow in and of themselves. It's that Babel would be a shrine to their own glory and not God's glory. The dream of Babel was this human-engineered city of strength and unity. These people had been nomads. They'd been wandering around, kind of scattering and moving east, spread out, living in tents. A city with brick walls and brick buildings was the promise of a more secure life. It was the promise of strength in numbers. It was something that if you were a nomad and you realize that if all of us get together and we build this city with our bricks, that other nomads won't attack us anymore. We'll be able to defend ourselves. We'll be safer. In fact, other nomads will look up to us. They'll envy us. And the clincher of all this was that the dream of Babylon was totally possible without God. Totally possible without God. And that same dream is alive and well today. There's this underlying belief that drives our culture that technology and human ingenuity are actually the hope of the world. Some people actually believe, and this is maybe you believe this. I shouldn't have said that in a way that was condescending. There are people who believe that the internet will save our planet. It's a very popular thought in modern technology right now. It's debated by some. There are some people like Bill Gates who say, no way, that's not true. The internet is not on the hierarchy. It's not, you know, the first five rungs of human needs. But others say it is. Others say it is. And there's this debate. And how can we change technology? How can we actually usher in the internet? It'll provide more jobs. It'll preserve natural resources and use less fossil fuels. It'll put an end to censorship. The voiceless will have a voice because of the internet. See, the people of Babel figured out how to make bricks. And we're figuring out how to expand the internet. We're figuring out how to cure diseases. And those can be very good things. But there's a dark side to this too. Because the same hands that make bricks make nuclear weapons. Medicine that is invented to cure diseases and help people are costing so much. The price is just gouging people so that wealthy people can have more money in their pockets. Greed is fueling some of the sales of medicines. The internet has done a ton of good, but it's also been a place of violence and exploitation and gossip and slander. And all this begs the question, is technology really making the world a better place? I mean, in many ways, it is. I'm really glad that I have hot water in my house and that it stays in pipes and then I can get it when I, you know, turn it on. I'm happy about that. I'm happy that there have been medical advances made against HIV and AIDS. But in spite of all these breakthroughs, humans we've made these breakthroughs in technology and medicine, but in spite of that, we're still dealing with the same old problems. The same stuff that's been dogging us since Babel and even before that are still dogging us today. Divorce, war, racism, disease, poverty. According to the United Nations, this blew my mind. According to the United Nations, 1.6 billion people, that's billion with a B, on our planet are living in extreme poverty. 1.6 billion. In the academic world, there's a debate over whether or not the world is actually becoming a less violent place or not. And this debate is happening, and there's some saying that it is becoming less violent, and then there's others that are saying, no, it's not becoming less violent. But the fact that there's even a debate about that tells you that we're really not getting anywhere with our technology and our innovations and our ingenuity. Here in the United States, we're in an election year, and I'm sorry to remind you of all that. We've been worshiping Jesus and singing songs and reading about Babel. Oh, this is good. I don't have to think about the election. But we're in this election year. And right now we have two candidates, and I don't know what your opinion is about either one of them or both of them. But I believe that if the world was becoming a better place, it would actually be reflected in the people who are running for office. I'm not throwing rocks at your candidate. I'm not throwing rocks at Donald Trump. I'm not throwing rocks at Hillary Clinton. But if we take a step back and we look at them, can't we say honestly that their sins are just exaggerations of our own? Can't we say that their idolatry of sex and money and power, aren't those things just things that are alive in us as well? Maybe they represent us better than we care to admit. To borrow the words of another pastor in our city, Rick McKinley, over at Imago Dei, he says that what this election reveals is that we really do need a God who can save us and heal us and set us free, because despite all of our collective will and voices and our own democratic process, this is the best we came up with. Putting our hope in human ingenuity and technology is a misguided idea. Because human ingenuity and technology are powerless against our greatest problem, human sin. Only turning to God can address sin. May we cry out to God for mercy. May we turn to Jesus who died to pay the price for our sins. May we turn to Jesus who alone can heal us and show us a better way to live. May we turn to Jesus whose resurrection from the dead gives us life with God forever that stretches beyond the 70 or 80 or 90 years that we get on this planet. Eternity with him forever. May we put our hope in Jesus. Turning to God is our only hope. It's true for us. It's true for our church. It's true for our city. It's true for the United States of America. It's true for the world. And it was true for Babel. In their attempt to create this godless utopia, the people of Babel were actually setting themselves up for failure. And so what God does is he intervenes. He steps in because that's what God does. He gets involved in our problems. When we go east, he comes to us. And that's exactly what he does. Instead of letting Babel be released to its own devices, he actually prevents it from moving forward. Look at verses 5 through 9. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the people were building. God came to them. They ran from him, but he came to them. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. God steps in, and he stops the progress of this city by confusing their language. Before God stepped in, they were all speaking the same language. They could all understand each other, but now Babel has literally become a place of babbling. It's become a place where people can no longer understand one another. And so they're forced to go their own separate ways. Ironically, this is the very thing that they were trying to avoid. They're trying to avoid being separated and spread out and nomadic and scattered all over the place. In fear, they were determined to band together and to build this city out of bricks. Their fear was driving them. Yet God messed up their plans because God's driving concern was not their peace and unity. And if we stop there and just think about that for a second, that God's driving concern was not their peace and unity. I mean, how much does that fly in the face of the God that we've made in our own image? God is all about my peace. That's what I signed up to follow Jesus for. God would actually take us to a place where we would have to be forced to let go of our human-made ways to find peace and comfort and security, that we'd actually have to let go of those and in our fear turn to him and trust him. That's his bottom line. That's more important. His greater concern for Babel was that they wouldn't become slaves to their own pride, that they wouldn't get into this destructive habit of trying to do life without him. So God makes Babylon fail. And I think it's one of the most merciful things that God can do. It's one of the most merciful things that God can do. He established, in causing this to fail, he established that his plans ultimately won't be thwarted by our own plans. Now, sometimes our failed plans are actually an act of God's mercy in our lives. Anytime we strive for the good life without God, the consequences are devastating. We deceive ourselves into thinking that we can solve our own problems, that somehow because our sin and our and our hearts that are rebelling against God, actually that goes unchecked. So when God steps in and messes up our plans, it's actually an act of mercy. Some of you have experienced this. You've experienced God wrecking your life. And I'm laughing not because it's funny, because maybe you're on the other side of it, and you can actually see his mercy in it. You can actually see his grace in not letting you maybe get that promotion that you hoped to get. You've seen it was painful and it was disappointing. You had some friends who turned on you and you lost community. But now you see that God was actually protecting you. He was caring for you. A failed business venture. As the sting of disappointment has worn off, you're actually seeing God's care. You're actually seeing that trusting him instead of your own version of the good life, instead of trusting your own ideals, your own quest to create your own utopia, is actually better. See, so much of our pursuit of the good life, it's about needing to not be needy. That's what we are driven by. We're offered all these clever ways to reduce our needs. Technology and marketing and medicine and so many of these things are gifts from God. And they're good things. But in the reducing of our own needs and in reaching that level of comfort that we think is ideal for us, that level of security where we feel like we won't ever have to worry anymore, actually can take us to a place where we are ultimately free of our need for God. For you, maybe this looks like getting a certain size paycheck. Everything's getting more expensive in Portland, isn't it? We're feeling this in our house. You're feeling it in yours, too. Real estate's more expensive. Groceries are more expensive. It's like, it's. And how am I going to get what I need? Well, the way I'm going to get what I need is if somebody starts paying me more, right? And we all have a number in our head, right? You have a number in your head. If I hit this level of financial security, then I can check that one off the list and never have to worry about it again. For others of us, it's a relationship. We want a spouse desperately, and we're trusting the internet to find one for us. Because for some of us, being married is the only way we'll think we'll ever feel secure. Or maybe you want a different house. Maybe you want a bigger one. Others of you want a smaller one. Like you want a tiny one, right? That's getting popular. You want to live in a little ADU in somebody's backyard. It doesn't matter, you know, if you want a bigger one or a smaller one. When you get that house, then you'll be comfortable. We could all come up with our own ideas for how we try to free ourselves of our need for God. But what Jesus invites us to is, instead of striving to eliminate all of our needs like the people of Babel did, he actually calls us to embrace our need for him. We've got to remember that as promising as technology and human ingenuity are, they'll ultimately fail to deliver the comfort and security we long for. David, the warrior, the king of Israel, he was a great leader. He was a poet. He wrote in Psalm 20, he said, "Some trust in chariots, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." As king, David didn't put his hope in having the biggest and baddest army. I mean, Israel had tons of enemies. But David's hope wasn't in having really the best technology, the best chariots. He said, "We trust in the name of the Lord our God." Because David ultimately understood something. He understood that whether he won a battle or whether he lost a battle, he believed his ultimate comfort and his ultimate security were in his eternal relationship with God. That was where his comfort and security were found. In a relationship with God that he was enjoying in this life and that he knew he would enjoy forever. Psalm 23, David says that he summarizes this. He says, surely your goodness and your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, period, end of story. That is where I'm putting my hope and my comfort. That is where I'm going to find my security. David understood that flourishing is heaven. Flourishing is eternity with God forever. That's where we as followers of Jesus will ultimately flourish. We get tastes of it on earth. We get glimpses of it. But it's not because we've achieved a certain level of comfort or a certain level of security with a better house or because we have better medicine or whatever it is that you think is going to do it for you. It'll be because we know God and we love God and we'll be enjoying him forever. So we need to be a community as Mosaic that puts our sights on heaven. Ultimately, that's what we long for. Aiming for heaven is actually better than aiming for human progress. Human progress is setting our sights way too low, you guys. Way too low. It's not optimistic enough. C.S. Lewis argued that most people, if they looked at their hearts, would realize that the thing that they're most longing for is something that they'll never get on earth. God promises to deliver this. When Jesus came, he promised that his kingdom was at hand. He was bringing heaven to earth. And that kingdom would be fully realized in the future when he returns again, when he comes back again. When Jesus comes back, Revelation describes him establishing a new city, a city that puts Babylon to shame, a city that does what Portland could never do. This is a city where he rules and where he reigns. He rules in the heart of every person, a city that's free from sin. It's free to flourish. It's an eternal city. That's the destination we put our eyes on. It's higher and better than whatever hope we put in the internet to fix our problems or medicine to add a couple years to our lives. C.S. Lewis goes on to argue that when we occupy ourselves with heaven, we'll actually be more inclined to live it out on earth. Some of us have gotten away from heaven. Maybe we heard about heaven, we trusted Jesus because we had this idea that we would die and go to heaven. But we've sort of gotten away from that idea because so many of us have seen that as an escapist type of thing. Like this life is just, we're just biding our time to get to heaven. There's no point in really being here, you know, kind of we can just trash the place and live how we want because our hope is in heaven. Lewis argues that that's a bad understanding of heaven. That's just the wrong way to look at it. He argues that when we set our eyes on our flourishing in heaven, this eternal relationship with God that can never be taken away in a city that he establishes where he rules and he reigns. He argues that when we put our eyes there, we'll actually have impetus to bring heaven to earth, to live like it now. If you look at the history of humanity and the good things Christians have done for this planet and for our world, it's been by the people who most had their eyes set on eternity. Christians who ended the slave trade in England. Christians who led Rome, this godless city, to actually embrace Jesus. That as we fix our gaze on where our ultimate flourishing will happen, we'll actually want to bring that flourishing into our relationships on earth, into our own lives, that we'll be more submissive to Jesus, that we'll be more trusting, that we'll allow him to define freedom for us, that we won't go pursuing that on our own by heading east. That's God's vision for our life on earth and for eternity. And may that be the case at Mosaic. May heaven be our impetus as a church to love our city, to be generous with our time and with our money, to be a safe community where broken people can come as they are and be embraced by people who love them and a God who loves them. We're going to continue to worship and take communion. And as we come to this table, we're remembering the words of Jesus in John chapter 6. Jesus said that he's the bread of God, and that we have to actually eat him if we're going to have life. Now, that sounds a little bit strange to us, and it's not a literal thing. It's a thing that's represented in communion, that when we take a piece of bread and we dip it in the juice, we're remembering that Jesus' body was broken and his blood was shed for our sins, that Jesus has a better way than whatever we can come up with our best ideas, with our cool inventions, that he's the hope of the world. Jesus said that unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you're lifeless. You're lifeless. That life you want, that utopia you think you can build on your own, is always going to be out of reach. And so if you're a follower of Jesus this morning, and you find yourself wanting to put your hope in Jesus again, come to this table and do that. Lay down whatever dream you have of finding comfort and security, trying to sort of eliminate your need for God, lay that down at the table as you come forward and embrace his grace in your life. Let's worship. Let's take communion.